you got a beard, man. You're a bearded wonder.
That's right. That's my protest for having my foot all boogered up.
So this is a protest beard? Hi, everybody. Hey, welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm Todd Conklin. How are you today? It is, oh yes, it is. If my calendar serves me correctly, this is going to be nearly the first of, like the second or third of September, something like that. It's, I can't believe it's September already. I really can't. I was just like, man, the summer Zoom school's been on for a long time. It seems like school started like July 3rd. Well, either way, it's the year is progressing by, and it's been mighty crazy, just mighty crazy. I had a lot, so much going on. It's hard to figure out what to talk about. Life is grand and exciting, and today's podcast is pretty cool. It's pretty groovy. You're going to like it a lot, actually. I think you're actually going to. It was fun to make, and it was really fun to listen to, and it was fun to be a part of. I almost can't wait for you to hear it. You know, because adults are big, we like stories. So adults learn through storytelling. We teach through storytelling too, as well. And stories are great because they meet some tests for us that are pretty important. They have fidelity. They make sense to us. They move temporally. They move over time. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. They usually have a certain amount of tension, right? And there's usually a sort of a group of characters. And that somehow, somewhere, something goes through a process of transformation. It changes. And that is exactly, precisely, what's going to happen in this podcast. Is you're going to hear really two very tragic stories. I mean, these aren't good stories. These are tragic, tragic stories. But they're told in a way that you get to be the arbiter of the difference between the two. Which I think is exactly, precisely, what young Mr. Rigo intended for this to do. Bill, if you don't know him, Bill is, oh, look, my phone's ringing. How nice is that? Yes, so Bill is a great friend of the pod. There's no question about that. He's been on a bunch of times. And, you know, Bill and I sort of grew up together, even though he's way older. He's tremendously older than me. It's not even comparable. But we kind of grew up together in the DOE. And so we've been on this kind of New View journey a long time, and you know that Bill's a big engineer, so he's a Newtonian cat by education and definition and personality, but he's a Newtonian engineer that about, I don't know if I were to put a timeline on it, 15 years ago, he was kind of shocked into kind of the New View and understanding complexity and adaption, and he's sort of famous for doing things like crane investigations and safety, and he's just a New View cat. I mean, you can tell that right away. And he's going to talk to you in great detail about these two stories. So that's what's coming up on the podcast. I think you're going to find it to be great fun. Let's see. I'm trying to think what else I have to tell you. So all the stuff that's going on, especially around the ASSE, which is now ASSP, that's going to take me a long time, the American Society of Safety Professionals. Although I think the name's better, it's change is hard. Sometimes even change for the better is hard. That's going on. It's just been really interesting to see this New View stuff that we think about, sort of this complex adaptive understanding, the safety differently stuff, get more and more mainstream. I kind of wonder what that means for us. I wonder how that's going to manifest itself into what we do. It's going to be fun to watch. That's for sure. I'm looking forward to that. And as for me, well, golly, it's just, you know, got the big bluegrass festival coming up, third week of September, Winfield, Kansas. I'll be there because you can't spend enough time, with friends listening to bluegrass music. I mean, you could, but I've never hit that line yet. And it's always super fun. Maybe I'll see some of you there. If you're there, look me up. Probably I'll be somewhere on stage one or somewhere in the pecan grove listening to the parking lot picking, the campground picking, which is really the reason you go. You know I love bluegrass music, and if you don't, keep listening to the podcast. I'm almost going to guarantee you that Uncle Penn will be back on the podcast sooner, better than later. Who knows? Who knows where that all goes? But enough of me just kind of yakking around. Let's jump right into the conversation. This, my friends, is our friend of the pod, Bill Rigo, and he's going to tell the story of two tragedies, and he's going to talk about the difference and importance of prevention execution and resilience, right? But he's going to talk about it. I said that like it was prevention execution. Prevention, comma, execution, comma, and resilience, comma. They're three distinct things. And he's going to talk about really the power of recovery. So with no further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is Bill Rigo and a story or two.
I was reflecting on one of your podcasts not too long ago, and I was thinking back to your book, and so I'll pipe your book a little bit. But one of the things that you talk about in your book is there's three kinds of resilience, and you and I have gone back and forth on this for a while, but you talk about resilience in prevention, resilience in how work is accomplished, and then resilience in safeguards and control or recovery. And I think I get that. And, you know, our focus when we were with the Department of Energy was, you know, what we saw was a lot of prevention. You know, so we focused on work planning and pre-job briefs and things like that, but not so much in terms of the work or what would happen when the work went bad. And so I was thinking about, you know, have I had any interventions where I focused on recovery? Which seems to be, you know, an area that, you know, we don't see a lot. And I realized that I had. And so I was thinking back to my time on the USS Nimitz. I was on board that ship twice, once as the damage control assistant, or DCA, responsible for the shipboard firefighting. That was in 1979 to 81. And then I came back to the same ship as the chief engineer in 1987. And in the course of both those tours, I experienced two major flight deck fires. And a flight deck fire is extraordinarily rare. So to have one is rare, but to have two is, you know, I don't know what the odds are. But there was a safety intervention in between that I conducted. And so I want to talk about that. And so let me set up the first accident, and that was a flight deck fire. It was around midnight on May the 26th, 1981, and it was literally a dark and stormy night. So we were off the coast of Jacksonville, Florida. We were doing night aircraft carrier calls, and we were prepping for an upcoming deployment to the Mediterranean. And I had the watch. So I was the engineering officer of the watch down in main control, and I'm watching the airplanes launch and come back and get recovered. And we've got a camera down in main control that monitors all of that. And that camera is available all around the ship. But we watched it because we needed to know what was going on the flight deck. So I'm watching this EA-6B, which is a large electronics warfare aircraft with a crew of four. And it's pretty ungainly. And it came in and it bolted, so it landed and the tail didn't catch and it had to bolt off, and that's why they call it a bolter. So he's coming back for a second approach, and he's not looking real good, and he's all over the landing pattern, and I can hear the LSO, the landing signal officer, talking to him to get him on, you know, down on the deck. And the ship was passing in and out of thunderstorms, and it was a moonless night, so it was dark. And he came in, and he was way right of the center line, and his right wing clipped the nose of a couple of aircraft that were parked on the foul line near the landing area, and he cartwheeled into the what we call the crotch, which is it's an area up on the port bow, and it was the weapons arming, dearming area. And there were three F-14s up there. They had been fully fueled. They had a complementary wartime load of a Sparrow missile, a Sidewinder missile, a Phoenix missile, and a bunch of rounds of 20-millimeter ammunition. So he cartwheels into this area, he breaches the fuel tanks of a couple of the F-14s. You know, they release all their fuel. It catches fire, and there's these flames that go 100 feet in the air. So I saw this, and the ship went to general quarters. We immediately started the AFFF systems, the firefighting systems, to put firefighting foam up on the flight deck. And at that point, everything seemed to be going the way you would imagine it. It didn't end up going that way. So we this is something we think we're trained for, but we're not. And so the flames are shooting up. And immediately, one of the things that I realized was, is we went to general quarters, and the entire ship woke up, and they went to battle stations to fight this fire. We didn't have very good communications with the flight deck, and so we. All we knew was what we were seeing on the cameras. And so, you know, we're trying to get information. And it turns out it's just a giant goat rope. And we're in and out of thunderstorms, and the thunderstorms was washing the firefighting foam away from the flaming aircraft. And so we were running through all of our AFFF. And so we ended up, you know, made a lot of mistakes. We had equipment didn't work that we thought was supposed to work. And in the end, the fire went out in about 25 minutes the first time. And then a missile cooked off. And it blew the AFFF away from the plane. A ball of fire followed it. It killed the firefighting crew that was there providing cooling water for the weapons. And it reignited the flight deck again. And it took us another 40 minutes to finally put the fire out. And in the end, 14 men were killed. We had another 39 were very seriously injured and burned. We destroyed 11 aircraft. And there was $53 million in damages. It was interesting. In preparation for this podcast, I went back and read the Navy JAG investigation of the accident. And it was interesting. There are all these things that didn't work that I had forgotten about, and so the problems that the investigation noted was that the principal one was that the pilot of this aircraft was taking antihistamines because he had a cold and he needed to fly, and so this is his last opportunity to do a night arrested landing, and he had to do it on that night or he was not going to make the deployment. It was going to be adverse to his career. And he was a hotshot pilot. So there's lots of incentives for him to fly. Well, he didn't run this by the flight surgeon. And what he didn't understand was that antihistamines can induce vertigo while you're in flight, especially if it's a dark and moonless night with no evident horizon. So the JAG investigation principally blamed him. Which was interesting, but he was dead, so there's not much you can do about it. There was lots of issues with firefighting efforts and the thunderstorms, and the equipment didn't work the way we thought they were. There was lots of communications issues, and most surprisingly, we used up nearly every gallon of AFFF on the ship. We used up over 12,000 gallons of liquid firefighting foam. And I only had about 11,000 gallons in all of my tanks. And we had firefighters that were literally dumping 5-gallon bottles of AFFF into the tank so we could keep pumping it up to the flight deck. And so if we had run out of AFFF in the middle of that fire, it would have been much worse. The other thing that was interesting was that the centerline flashers that indicated where the centerline was for the pilot that was landing were inoperative that night. So he didn't have a good visual reference of the centerline when he was landing. And the investigation didn't make very much of that. Now, some of the deeper issues was that, and I knew this because I was the DCA for the ship, when I would hold ships general quarters drills, the Air Wing, which is about 2,000 people, and they owned all the aircraft and serviced them, they didn't participate in the ship's drills because they went to bed. And so the reason was because of crew rest. So the squadron commanders decided that crew rest was more important than firefighting training, and that's what they did. So when the fire hit, when the fire hit at midnight, and these guys are all on the ranks, and they're all very tired because we'd been underway for a long time, they didn't know what to do. And so they're literally underneath the fire in their berthing compartments, you know, which is right underneath the flight deck. And my firefighting crews that responded to general quarters were up there. And one of the things that they had to do was to clear these people from their bunks and get them out of danger. Now, these are the guys who were in their bunks who are supposed to be up in the flight deck fighting the fire. And so there was issues getting people up, you know, the right kind of people up to the flight deck to fight the fire. We had a number of communications issues because we didn't train together. And we had a lot of planned maintenance stuff that was, you know, that was my responsibility that related to the maintenance of the firefighting systems on the flight deck that hadn't been done because we couldn't get, you know, the flight deck scheduled in a timely fashion to get these maintenance things done. So, and then finally, when they did the autopsies on the dead, many of the men on the flight deck had marijuana in their system. So there was those sorts of issues. So the investigation had 33 recommendations, and most of them dealt with the equipment, you know, fix the equipment, but they had the usual amount of procedure changes for procedures that weren't ever read. And I just find it interesting, and you and I have talked about this a lot over the years, that, you know, why would you, how does changing a procedure that no one reads a fix for this problem? So, and then finally, they were going to issue me a letter of reprimand because I hadn't tried hard enough to get all the maintenance scheduled for the equipment that ultimately failed. And the chief of staff of the admiral went to the admiral and he said, "So let me get this straight. We've got a pilot who's abusing antihistamines in order to fly, ends up crashing the flight deck and killing 14 people, and we're going to discipline this engineer. How does that make sense? And coincidentally, how does this fix anything?" So I let the ship kind of, you know, a few months later with this hanging over my head, and I went off and did a few more things. But I came back to the ship in 1987 as the chief engineer, and I found that the conditions that had led up to that lack of recovery on the Nimitz still existed 6 years later.
Wow.
And so if it wasn't me that had come back, no one would have known, which is kind of scary.
It's remarkable, so, is what it is. That's just remarkable.
Well, you'd think. So I went to the, but it gets better because I went, so I decided, okay, we're going to have an intervention here. And I went to the air wing commander, and the air wing commander who was there, who was on his way out, was actually the same air wing commander for the previous accident. And the Navy had changed the how they did the air wing commanders. That used to be a senior commander, and then they changed it to being a mid-grade captain. And so this guy, and his call sign was Bad Fred. I'm not sure what that means, but anyway, so I went up to talk to Bad Fred, and I relayed, okay, here's the inside story on the fire, and we'd both been part of the investigation, and I said, we've got to figure out how we can have coordinated training and for you to participate, and he agreed that it needed to be done. He acknowledged that, you know, we had to work it out, and I said, look, my commitment to you is I'm going to schedule these things at a mutually agreeable time. And so we'll do it to whatever schedule you see fit. but you got to play. And he says, I'm with you 100%. And off we went. We did our training. He left a few months later and was replaced by another guy, but the agreement stood. So a year later, we're in the Arabian Sea following the 1988 Olympics, for which we provided air cover. And it's the 30th of November. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. We've got the bow is tightly packed with aircraft. There's maintenance going on the aircraft up on the flight deck. We've done engineering drills up until about 11 o'clock that night. I'd gone to bed around midnight, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, I get this, this insistent buzz from the engineering office, the watch. And he informed me, he said, engineer, get up, get dressed, get down to central control. The ship's on fire. And at that point, the general quarters alarm went off, and I turned on my television to see what was going on as I was getting dressed, and there were flames 100 feet high in about the same place as the previous accident. So what happened? So what was going on that night? They were doing maintenance on aircraft, and so a couple of ordnance techs from one of the squadrons were working on the gun of an A-7 that had a gripe on it. And a pilot said, it didn't fire the way he thought it was supposed to. So the ordnance tech bypassed around. He jumped around the 17 interlocks that prevent the gun from firing, including the weight on wheels interlock, and pulled the trigger, as he had done many, many times before. The thing that he hadn't done was to check to see that the gun was unloaded. So with obviously all the safety interlocks jumping around, the gun fired. Now, the gun was pointed at – normally, if you do something like that, you make sure that the plane is pointed someplace over the side. But in this particular case, it's pointed at a fully loaded KA-6 tanker that had about 10 to 12,000 gallons of JP-5 in it. And there were two techs that were working on that plane. And so it went up in flames. Those two techs on that plane died as a result of their burns. And about seven aircraft erupted in flames because they were densely packed. So this part of the story is very short because we went to general quarters. Everything went perfectly, and the fire was out in 11 minutes. We lost the two men who were working on the accident plane. We lost seven aircraft that went over the side. They were too badly burned to recover. But we didn't have a scratch. There were no other injuries. And I can't remember a flight deck fire that has gone that well. And, in fact, the JAG investigation commended the firefighting efforts. But it really was the overall organization, how we approached the recovery efforts. And it went back to that conversation I had with the Air Wing Commander a year earlier that set all that up for success. And the rootier root of the investigation was command climate. So what was going on was the squadron commander for that squadron that where they pulled the trigger was getting rewarded by the current Air Wing Commander for getting his planes in the air when the other squadron commander of the same A-7 squadron couldn't. So he was... he was managing to get his airplanes up, and nobody knew how. And, of course, we understood later that he was cutting all kinds of corners. So the end of the story was that the two ordnance technicians ended up going to prison for 5 years. The squadron commander and the squadron XO lost their jobs, and the air wing commander lost his job. So in the Navy, there's always, you're always looking for scalps, and this proved to be one where it did. And I'm not a big fan of punishment, but in this particular case, that they didn't stop the guy who touched it last, the ordnance tech, they did go to leadership to explain their own particular responsibility for this. So. This was a story of a safety intervention, and you don't get a lot of these on your podcast. In fact, I think this may be the only one where the leadership of an organization took a safety intervention. It was specifically geared towards recovery efforts, you know, because we assumed that a flight deck fire was going to happen since it had. And when it did, it actually went pretty much as we thought it was going to go. So we don't often have these types of examples where you go in for a very unlikely accident and then have it happen again and have a different outcome. So does that all that make sense?
A ton of sense. And I think what's interesting, yeah, so firefighting is a really good example for this idea of recovery resilience, because the prevention stuff is all very important. And I'm sure as the engineer in both cases, you've done dramatic amount of prevention work. The actual execution stuff mostly would be successful because mostly you don't have flight deck fires. We've already established that. So when you have an execution failure of some type, jumping 17 interlocks, that's a pretty elaborate execution failure, then your recovery systems, because you were so much smarter, because you'd recovered and restored from a horrific tragedy, really, you saw what needed to be bolstered and strengthened, which was the ability to recover, to communicate, to respond. That's quite a story, actually, Bill, and amazingly painful, actually.
Yeah. Well, there was fatalities on both ends, but it was a lot fewer on the second one than it certainly could have been.
So what's your lesson that you would take out to the world today? What, coming off the end of these two stories, what's the path forward? What would you recommend people start thinking about?
Well, it kind of gets back to your book. I was rereading some of that this morning, and it's, you know, when you look at all your controls and you look at what's the worst possible thing that could happen and what are your controls, and then is it enough? And we recognized, you know, of course, we obviously hadn't read your book at that point since it was 30 years ago. But we recognized that what we had in place wasn't good enough. And when it's not good enough, you can't ignore that. And that's the conundrum of leadership, is when you see something that you can't ignore, you've got to do something about it, or it's just a failure of leadership. You shouldn't even be there. The other thing in hindsight that I kind of regret, although I don't regret much, is that we learned this lesson on the Nimitz, but we didn't learn this lesson on the other 12 aircraft carriers in the Navy. So as far as I know, they were doing business the same way that we were before, you know, I'd gotten there. And so we just didn't have the mechanisms to get those sorts of lessons to be learned out to the rest of the fleet. And it was, you know, so it's not, I don't think it's good enough to fix your recovery problems. You got to tell people about it. And you kind of address this in your book as well, is you got to tell people what you did and what was successful and why it was successful.
And one of the things I think is so interesting is this bias towards prevention. When the lessons to be learned do get out, they almost always are sold as don't be this vessel, don't be this ship. Don't jump through 17 interlocks. Don't fly when you're on cold medicine.
Yeah.
Right. And so we tend to bias towards the prevention side, which those are important lessons, no question about it. But to me, the real learning that you brought forth in this story is not the learning of the prevention strategy. It's the learning of the recovery strategy. Man, that's incredible, Bill. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for that story.
Well, you're welcome. I hope it plays well. I would be interested in any feedback you get, because, you know, I still think about this.
So that's the podcast for today. What'd you think? I think it's great that Bill asked for feedback. Let's see if we can come up with some. Send it to me, toddconklin@gmail.com. That's fine. Bill's pretty easy to find, too. Stay tuned, because this was he thought about this a lot before he put this podcast together with me. I mean, he really wanted to sort of show that comparison, and I appreciate it greatly. I think it's the right thing to think about, but I'm still wide open. I mean, I just am. But I think we don't really have very good tools at managing prediction of aberrant situations, of surprises. We're not very good at predicting surprises. And if we're not good at predicting surprises, then we probably better get good at controlling for consequence. And that's kind of where this all sort of heads out. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? Lots more coming. It's a good year for podcasting. Thanks for listening. I can't believe the numbers. It's a little bit humbling. It's actually a lot humbling to see the numbers we have, but that's kind of cool. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, subscribe, for goodness sake. Subscriptions really seem to make a big difference to the podcasting community. But if you get a chance, just go in there and click subscribe. It's not hard. Doesn't cost you nothing. Don't cost you nothing. And there's just a ton more. God, this year is so – there's so many. I can't even tell you all the great things. I could, but it would be ruining the surprise. All the great things that are coming up. And so that'll be fun as well. So I hope you get what you need. That's important. Have as much fun as you possibly can. Learn something new every single day. I bet you did today. And for goodness sakes, remember, be safe.
That's right. That's my protest for having my foot all boogered up.